Good evening, and welcome to the 3rd Legislative District live telephone town hall with Senator Andy Billig and Representatives Tim Ormsby and Marcus Riccelli. My name is Jack, and I'll be moderating tonight's call. We're calling you tonight to give you an opportunity to ask your elected representatives any questions you might have on issues like the state budget, education, jobs, transportation, or public safety. If you have a question for Senator Billig or Representatives Ormsby or Riccelli, all you need to do is press star 3 on your phone and we'll connect you with a volunteer who will place you in the question queue. Pressing star 3 right now is all you need to do to ask your elected official a question on tonight's call. Again, this is a live telephone town hall. We're calling you tonight because you are a registered voter in the 3rd Legislative District and your elected representatives want to hear from you on the issues you care about. We'd like to get as many questions as possible in, so again, press star 3 if you'd like to ask a question tonight. Now I'll turn it over to your legislators for some opening remarks. Senator Billig, why don't you begin?
Great. Thank you, and thanks to everybody who's spending a few minutes with us on the line today. We work for you, and to do our jobs well, we need to hear your input. So that's why we do town hall meetings in person in the district. We do teletown halls. We have email and newsletters and all kinds of ways to communicate. And tonight, obviously, teletown hall is the way we're reaching out. So we're just going to make some brief remarks, but mostly we'd like to hear questions from you so we can talk about the things that are on your mind. I serve on three committees, on the Early Learning K-12 Education Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, and the Rules Committee, and then I also serve in leadership as the Deputy Minority Leader. And the issues that I work on particularly, we're all sort of generalists and work on all kinds of issues, but I really focus on education issues, particularly early learning. I've done a lot on voter access this session and campaign finance reform. And we're also, all of us, been working on transportation, but working on trying to do a transportation revenue package to bring to pass at some point this year. And I think I'll pause there and turn it over to Representative Ormsby.
Well, thank you, Senator Billig, and thank you all for joining us in this telephone town hall. And we really appreciate you turning in because, as you know, being 350 miles away from your state capital, it's often difficult to interact with your legislators. So we really do appreciate the time that you're taking to interact with us while we are here in Olympia. And I'd like to begin by saying how thrilled I am to work with both Senator Billig and Representative Riccelli. I think we bring a real team approach to this business of governing and this business of trying to do the best for our 3rd District constituents. I would also like to give a shout out to the people that work in our office, in Senator Billig's office. He's ably staffed by Kate Burke, Johnny and Maureen, Representative Riccelli by Michaela Williams and Sam, his intern, and myself, Shannon Wechter, and Kendra Coburn, our intern. It is really helpful for you to feel confident giving them information because they're very good at extending it to us. I will just say my committee assignments, I'm the vice chair of the Appropriations Committee, which is the House Budget Writing Committee, which involves everything that the state spends money on in general government. I'm also a member of the Labor Committee. And with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Riccelli, but I'll just remind you to press star 3 on your touch-tone phone to get in the queue to ask questions.
Thank you, Representative Ormsby, and thank you all for joining us. It's very important to have folks actively engaged in our public policy-making process, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy evening to join us. I serve on the Healthcare Committee, which I vice chair, Capital Budget and Transportation Committee. Some of my focuses this year have been around healthy kids and healthy families, and that is extending from working with the team of legislators here on everything from the WSU Medical School to working with, on a somber note, a family of the tragic shooting at Deaconess Hospital, Sheena Henderson, to look at ways we can improve mental health outreach. Also, trying to bring grant kitchen equipment so we can serve nutritious foods in our schools. So those are just a number of the things that I'm working on, and we really do work as a team here. And I want to leave it at that because tonight's really about the questions that you have and us providing feedback from here in your capital.
Great. Thanks for those introductions. And just a reminder, everyone, press *3 to ask a question on tonight's telephone town hall. So we're going to start off with a question from Meg. Meg has a question about the UW and WSU men's schools. Meg, go ahead. You're live on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'm convinced that the state would be well served by both medical schools, and I think it's kind of bad form that they argue back and forth. What I would like to see is the state, is both schools come up with a program that would subsidize medical students in exchange for some commitment, a period of time, that once they had their degrees, that they would work in the underserved areas of Washington State, where you know, many people live way too far from a doctor to be practical. I'd like to see that happen.
Thanks, Meg. I'd like to begin with the second part of your question, which had to do with providing help to students, healthcare professionals, to serve in underserved communities and in underserved, you know, where they don't have enough of the right kind of healthcare professionals. And what's really important in part of our budget development process is to return to a program that we had done in the past, but during more difficult economic times it went by the wayside, and that is the Health Professionals Loan Repayment Program. That if people will agree to serve in needed professions in underserved communities, the state will take on retiring of their debt from their school years. And for physicians and other professionals, they can come out of school with a debt of over six figures, but we want to provide some relief to them so that they will be incentivized to serve those areas that don't have as great a healthcare access as we'd like.
Thanks, Meg, for your question, and I just wanted to add to what Representative Ormsby said. Well, like you, and I think everybody in this room, we are extremely supportive of WSU Medical School, and the first portion of that is changing a law from 1917 to allow basically what is a monopoly that UW has to make that go away so that we can pave the path for WSU Medical School. And you're right about rural areas and how our state is being served in other areas. Right now, over 52% of the doctors are in King County when they have 27% of the population. And we're going to need 1,700 new doctors by 2030. So it's absolutely the right time. We can grow medical education on both fronts, and I'm excited that we have bipartisan support from all of our state to do it.
Great, thank you, and thanks, Meg, for the question. So for those of you who are just now joining us, this is a live telephone town hall with your senator and representatives from the 3rd Legislative District. If you want to ask a question live on the air tonight, all you have to do is press *3, and you'll be connected to a screener who will put you in the question queue. Again, all you have to do is press *3 to ask a question tonight. So now we're going to take a question from Joanne. Joanne, go ahead. You're live on the air.
Thank you. I'm in concern about the medical that some of these people that are being put into jail are not receiving, and in the mental condition that they're in, they come in and they go right back out and they repeat themselves, and they're not taking care of the medications that they need and the proper diagnosis for them before they get out and they go full bore again. We haven't done anything really to curb that problem.
Well, thank you so much for the question. This is Representative Riccelli, and I want to let you know that we are concerned about that as well. And one of the most bipartisan things I think we're working in Olympia right now is mental health, because I think that the need doesn't see party lines. Folks understand that we are actually incarcerating people that do belong getting mental health treatment. So we're very focused on that. We're going to continue to focus on that. There's a number of solutions people are proposing, from integrating behavior and mental health to looking at how we are working on our prison population and not incarcerating people who belong getting treatment.
I would just add to what Representative Riccelli said, Joanne, and this is Tim Ormsby. It is a huge bipartisan effort, and we've been told by the federal district court that we are not doing a good enough job, and we have to make investments in people that are that psychiatric patients that are being boarded in hospitals when they should be in adequate mental health evaluation facilities, and people that are languishing in jail waiting for a competency hearing or a psychiatric evaluation. The courts have told us that we have to do it. So not only was it the wrong thing to do the way the state had approached this in the past, it's also unconstitutional. So we have a definite charge from the courts and have to assume the responsibility to do a much better job in serving the population that has these challenges.
And just one quick comment to add. This is Andy Billig. You know, kind of a shout out to our Spokane region, because we're leaders in the state in smart justice reform and particularly therapeutic courts. So, you know, one of the things that we could do best, if somebody has committed a crime because they're mentally ill, jail just may not be the best place for them. If we've got, and we do have in our region, through the community court, the mental health courts, and the other therapeutic courts, the ability to give people an option to stay out of jail to address the root issue that's causing the problem, which is not only going to help that individual person to live with dignity and to solve their issues, but it's also going to save us all a lot of money as a state and as a region. So I look at continuing to support those efforts locally.
All right, thanks. And thanks for the question, Joanne. Remember, all you have to do is press *3 to get put in the question queue. All right, now we're going to take a question from Ed about transportation. Ed, go ahead. You're live.
Yes. In your opening, I can't remember which one of you was referring to it, but there was a comment about transportation expenses, and you were looking at enhancements. Enhancements I've heard before through other legislative bodies have boiled down to nothing but new taxes and fees. Is that what you folks have in mind?
Well, thank you for the question, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. When we talk about a transportation revenue package, we're talking about revenue coming mostly from a gas tax. And so really the question is, do we want to invest more in our transportation system? And I think the answer is yes, and I'll tell you the reason. Because our transportation infrastructure is so important to the prosperity of our state. It's not only about getting to work, it's about getting the products that we build and grow in this state to port and export it overseas. We're the number one exporting state in the country. And when we think locally about projects like the Central City Line, like the North Spokane Corridor, those will only get done if we do a transportation revenue package. And with gasoline at such a low price now, it may be the right time to do it. But in any case, I think investments are warranted. The last thing I'll say is I think there's also a strong need for preservation and maintenance of our roads. We have dropped the ball as a community. I mean, just, you know, overall, all of us have not properly funded transportation to the point that we're able to keep up with maintenance. So we need to maintain what we have as well. And that also would be in a transportation package. It hasn't passed. We're working on it. It may not pass because it sounds like maybe you have a concern on it. There may be others that have concerns, but I'm hoping that everybody looks to the future and our future prosperity and see the need for it.
Thanks, Senator Billig. This is Representative Riccelli, and I just wanted to add in, you know, I think we absolutely need to look at a multimodal package, and that means transit isn't just in Seattle. We have a Central City Line we want to build upon. We have a U-District Bridge, safe routes to schools, and $750 million to complete the North Spokane corridor to the interstate. But for me, what it boils down to is last year there was a father of some elementary students down here from Shaw Elementary, living right in the area where the North Spokane corridor would go through. And I asked him, he said, when do you think that North Spokane corridor is going to get done? And I asked him, well, would you be willing to pay a little gas tax? He said, well, it's not my most exciting thing that I'd like to be doing, but I would do it if it gets done. And when I talk to seniors and I ask them to raise their hands, do you want to see that program that highway that started before I was born get done? And they chuckle, and I ask them to raise their hands, and there's hands that go up in the room. So it's time to get it done, and the gas prices sure are primed to move on a package. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get something that will be a strong investment and put men and women back to work in our community.
All right, thank you. And for anyone who's just joining us, this is a live telephone town hall with your senator and representatives from the 3rd Legislative District. Tonight, if you have a question that you'd like to ask live on the air, all you have to do is press star 3, and you'll be connected with a volunteer who will put you in the question queue. Again, all you have to do is press star 3 to ask a question live on the air. All right, now we're going to take a question from Dr. Barbara Weber. Barbara, you're live.
Yeah, hi. This is I was participating in your little town meeting you had a couple years ago, and I asked a question about gifted education. Dr. and Senator Billy and I had been writing back and forth, and I'm just curious whether what's being done about that. One of the things you were concerned about was eliminating the gap or lessening the gap between your middle class students and your lower economic students. And I sent several articles to Mr. Billy about finding gifted children in the Title I schools, and that is the fastest way you can close the gap educationally between those students. And having a mandated gifted program, whether it's funded or unfunded, but a mandated gifted program for all children in the state of Washington. And I'm just wondering what's happening to that.
Okay, well, Barbara, thank you for that question. I think, well, first of all, I appreciate the advocacy that you've done, and you've really helped to educate me and keep this issue at the front of my mind. One of the things that I think happens in Olympia is that we get focused on sort of the big thing. And right now the big thing is funding education to meet the Supreme Court obligation. And there's some very specific things in law that we need to fund, MSOC, which are the textbooks and electrical bills and that kind of thing, all-day kindergarten, and class size reduction. So I think what happens is we get so focused on those, and maybe rightly so, because that's what we are obligated to do by law right now, that then those other things, like we're working on a lot of other education issues, but gifted education is one of those ones that sometimes gets pushed to the back. So I would say it's not I don't have great news to report, but we're going to keep working on it, and there's a core group of legislators here who have that as a priority. So we'll try to make some progress this year, but I think you'll see the main focus being on the basic education related to the Supreme Court decision.
Great. All right. Thank you, and thank you for your question, Barbara. All right. Now we're going to take a question from Michael about education. Michael, go ahead. You're live.
Hi. First, I'd like to say hi to Andy, since I was the first Republican on the South Hill to put a vote for Andy Billig sign in my yard. But anyway, here's the question. Every time the election comes up, everybody says they're going to promote education, do something for education. My wife went back to school after our kids got in junior high and high school to become a teacher. She went to Gonzaga, graduated, and has taught for 14 years now. And part of the package when she took that job was that they would get a cost of living increase. She's been teaching, as I said, this is her 14th year. She has gotten 2 cost of living increases. And she now makes only about maybe 30% more money than she was making 35 years ago working in data communications. So my question is, are they ever going to get the cost of living increases?
Michael, this is Senator Billigan. First of all, thank you. Appreciate your comments. One of the reasons different ones of us are responding on different questions is that team that Representative Ormsby and Representative Riccelli were talking about. So we have different issues that we sort of specialize in, although we certainly work on all of the issues together. So education is one of the areas I work on. The COLA, you're absolutely right, and it was voted on by the voters of Washington State. It's well-deserved by our educators who are doing hard work every day in our schools educating our state's children, and it is a priority to get that done for me. I think Representative Ormsby and Riccelli would say the same thing, and I think that it will I'm optimistic that it will get done this year, but that's not good enough. We need to do better in how we pay teachers even beyond the COLA and make sure that COLA is there for future years. So I appreciate you bringing it up, and we'll keep advocating for it.
Hello, Michael. This is Tim Ormsby, and I just want to follow up on Senator Billig's comments about what the legislature is prepared to do. And I'll just reference the governor's budget because both the House and the Senate are working separately on budget items. But I'd just like to highlight a couple of things that the governor put in his budget, which was to fund the COLA for the upcoming next two-year cycle. And in addition to funding the COLA that's in law, providing another $150 million to supplement that COLA. And I know from our budget work here in the House, those are priorities for us to make sure that we are attracting and retaining the best professionals in whatever capacity in that the state pays for, whether it's in state agencies, but most certainly in our schools. And I'd like to express my personal gratitude to your wife for being on the front lines and educating the next generation of leaders.
All right, thank you, and thanks, Michael, for your question on that very important topic. So now we're going to take a question from Marshall on medical marijuana laws. Marshall, go ahead. You're live.
Hello, Marshall.
Are you there? Marshall, are you still on the line? All right. Looks like we lost Marshall. Too bad. Hey, remember, all you have to do tonight is press *3, and you'll be connected with a volunteer who will put you in the question queue to ask a question live on tonight's telephone town hall. All right, so we're going to take a question from Denise now about the budget. Denise, go ahead.
Thank you, gentlemen, for letting us have this opportunity. And what my question is, especially considering the fact that we do have the marijuana bill going on in Washington State, and we, you know, have the lottery in Washington State, and I hear, what I'm hearing is I'm hearing somebody say, the gas is low, the gas is low, you know, we can't think like that anymore. We have to change the way we do things. And we need to quit putting it off onto children, whether it be schools. And we need to quit putting it on the people that have worked 30 and 40 years of their lives. And then we want to do what? Another income tax or another gas tax. I want to know where the money's going that you're getting off these programs now.
Thank you, Denise. This is Tim Ormsby, and I would just like to put in perspective both the marijuana revenue that's coming into the state and also the lottery money, which is also dedicated to education. And just to put that into perspective, Denise, in combining the marijuana revenue that we're expecting as soon as this market matures a little bit and it's up and running, and you combine that with the lottery money in combination, that's less than 1% of the state revenue that comes in. So while it helps to fund education, it is not a windfall. It's about a half of 1%, frankly. It is not going to be the windfall that is going to resolve all of our budget challenges. And although those things are dedicated to help out with our general fund obligations, our the checkbook that the state uses to pay our bills and to keep state government going, it is not that big of a chunk of it, considering that our K-12 obligation alone is $15 billion and rising. So I just want to put that in perspective. I certainly understand that people have tax fatigue because it's a big conversation, but I'd also like to put that in perspective historically. If we went back 20 years to 1995, the people in Washington State were spending 7.5% of their personal income on state and local taxes. At the end of this biennium, that's going to be June 30th of 2015, we'll be spending 4.5% of our total state income on state and local taxes. So I want to put in perspective, no one likes paying taxes, but we have reduced by 40% the amount of money based on personal income that taxpayers are giving to state and local governments to run their programs. No one likes paying it, but the cost of a civil society is that we fund programs that maintain our civil society, and that this idea of taxation is the thing that we do together that none of us could do individually. And I stole that line from Senator Billig, by the way. But that is what we need to do. And I think that there's a lot of angst about taxation, and in perspective, we're paying a lot less now based on our personal income than we used to. And I'd like us to get away from this idea of, yes, we need the money, but it needs to come from someone else. Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree. And that guy's gone. So it's going to be up to all of us to do our fair share to make government work.
And I'll just add, that was a great synopsis, Tim, about kind of where we're at. But one of the questions we always ask, how much does it cost right now? We look at a two-year budget cycle in Olympia. We look at the short term. But I think we need to be reframing the question, how much does it cost to not fund things? Early learning, social services, mental health, what is the human and societal cost? At one point in the third district, over 56% of folks use some sort of form of social services. That's our most vulnerable. That's our veterans. That's our seniors. So the discussion we want to have is, what do we want as a state? What do we want our budget to reflect? What are our values? And that's the conversation we're having. And it doesn't just come at nothing. For the last few years in the recession, folks have been asked to do more with less. The truth is, we are doing less with less, and it's coming at the cost to our kids, to our seniors, our veterans, and to our communities.
All right, thank you. Now we're going to take a question from Dan about campaign finance reform. Dan, go ahead.
Yes, I'm not sure who this is would be best suited to answer, but I think it should be on all three of you's minds. But who's working on campaign finance reform legislation in a run-up to the 2016 election cycle?
Sorry, who's working on it, or what are we working on? Dan, could you just repeat
anything
again?
With that topic?
Yeah, so that's something I've really worked specifically on, and we've got a couple bills in play right now. One would increase campaign finance transparency for nonprofits like 501c4s and also 527 groups like the American Crossroads. Right now, those organizations don't have to disclose their donors like other political action committees do, and it's just dark money. It's secret money. And so we've got a bill, Senate Bill 5153, if you want to look it up on the legislative website, which is a really easy website to use. That bill would require those organizations to disclose their donors so we can trace the money and see who's financing these elections. We have one other bill that would restrict what we call shadow PACs, where organizations set up a PAC to basically hide their money. So two pretty big bills that would really go a long ways. I got to tell you, these are tough bills to pass. There's a lot of people. Nobody testifies in the hearings against the bills, but there are some. But it still is a challenge. So I really appreciate that you asked the question, and I hope you'll contact all the other legislators you might be able to interact with to encourage them to support these or other campaign finance initiatives.
And I just want to add, and again, thank Senator Billig for his leadership, particularly on this issue. From a larger standpoint, though, I think one of the worst decisions we've had through our Supreme Court was a Citizens United ruling. So we are passing down here resolutions asking for a constitutional convention to address Citizens United. I think I can speak to three of us. We don't believe corporations are people, and that this is casting a very dark shadow over our democracy, and our democracy is at risk. So I'm pleased. It's a long process to go after this issue, but it's something I think we're all committed to trying to change in the long run.
And just one other point I'll add, and thank you for mentioning that, because this is certainly a national issue as well as a state issue. But one of the things is I've done a lot of research about our state compared to other states. We've passed two citizens initiatives that have put our current campaign finance system in place, and we have a great system compared to other states. We have pretty low limits in terms of contributions and a really good disclosure website with the Public Disclosure Commission. So thank you very much for that question.
And if I may just throw in one more thing, Dan, and it is on all of our minds, and we are the recipients of campaign contributions, but I'd like to go back to that Citizens United decision and what the court said to all the people that opposed it. They said, surely, if all the things that you say are going to happen when this is implemented, Surely the Congress will rectify that by passing measures that take care of that problem. Well, we all know that Congress has done nothing in the face of exactly everything that the opponents to the decision said was going to happen, and Congress has done nothing. And as Senator Billig mentioned about how difficult it is to pass these bills, the Supreme Court was under the impression that surely the Congress would take care of that. That's how difficult it is on the national level, and it's difficult on the state level as well. But we, with Senator Billig's leadership, we're certainly trying to make every effort to get those issues taken care of.
All right. Thank you, all three of you, for your responses to that question. All right, everyone, we are halfway through tonight's telephone town hall. So if you haven't pressed *3 yet to ask a question, make sure you do that now so we have time to get to your question in tonight's call. Again, press *3 to be connected with a volunteer that will put you in the question queue. Now we're going to take a question from Robert about vaccines. Robert, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen, for having this town hall. I'll be real quick. Heard about the forced vaccination bill that was introduced last week, and I'm very concerned about our ability to choose what we want in the way of health freedom. And I was wondering if that does, or where you guys stand on that position, each one of you, and will the doctors, go ahead.
Go ahead, Robert. When you were done, I just wanted to ask a clarifying question. Go ahead.
Okay. Will the doctors still be required to hand out the indemnity form, and will the state of Washington compensate families who have some of the severe reactions from the shots? So I'm done.
Robert, the clarifying question I wanted to ask was when you said the forced vaccination bill, what is your understanding of what the bill is doing? So maybe we can speak to it, because there's a couple of different things that are going on in the legislature, just so we know your understanding of the forced vaccination issue.
Yeah, sorry, I just got the call, and I thought this is a perfect opportunity. It was the ladies from over the West Side. She introduced a bill that would remove the philosophical exemption, so all that would be left was the medical and then the religious. So people who maybe had questions, who maybe didn't want to give their kids the full spectrum of vaccines, maybe wanted to not do one but do the others, they wouldn't have that choice. They'd have to do them all. That was my thinking.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert. As Vice Chair of the Healthcare Committee and a parent of two young kids, my position is pretty strong on this. I did sign on to that bill. I do want to mention for those on the call that we will be hearing it in House Healthcare on Tuesday, next Tuesday, if you want to tune on TVW. But for me, this is a public health issue, and it's about keeping our kids safe and healthy. Vaccines are proven to work. Parents have legitimate questions but should follow the advice of doctors, and I truly feel the science is clear. So that is my position. I think that there will be a healthy discussion and debate over this topic, but let's not forget that it's important we do this now. There's been a rising rate of anti-vaccination sentiment in America, and the current outbreak shows that these diseases spread quickly.
So, and thanks, Representative Richelli. This is Andy Billig. And, you know, I think you'll hear on almost every issue we agree, but you don't want us to be robots, right? You want us to think individually. And so here's one where we have a little bit of a different opinion. I believe that most vaccines are appropriate for most children according to the schedule the CDC gives. However, I have a problem with the parents not making the final decision on medications that their kids are going to have to take. Now, I absolutely believe in the value of vaccination. So I think there's people out there that are saying vaccinations don't have value or they're dangerous. I don't say that. I think they are valuable, and I encourage people to get vaccinations. But for instance, there are parents who want to make a choice about maybe one vaccination not being appropriate because of this reason or that reason, or maybe the schedule recommended by the CDC doesn't feel right to them because they're concerned about a certain amount of the byproducts that are in there being administered all in one single month rather than spreading it out. I think those are legitimate concerns for parents. I'd encourage parents to get the vaccinations, but I think ultimately the parents should be making the final healthcare decision. I think that there's a way on this bill, and what I'll be advocating for is to maybe make the bar a little bit higher if somebody doesn't want their kids to be vaccinated according to the CDC schedule, but I don't think I would support a flat-out removal of the personal exemption.
And I want to just follow up, and I thank Senator Billig for his thoughts. that, you know, this hearing will be on Tuesday. And I've actually talked to a couple folks who are opposed, and they said they're coming from Spokane, and that's part of democracy, and we're going to make sure that their voices are heard during the committee process. I've committed to them that they're absolutely going to get their time to speak in front of the committee, and that's what this process is about. It's about a healthy dialogue and differing opinions, and at the end of the day, we take a vote, and we stand by our votes.
And I don't belabor this issue and want to get on to the other questions, but it is really a relevant thing that's going on. And I would say for me, and this is Tim Ormsby, there is a really need to respect and honor the rights of parents. But I also think we need to balance that with the rights of other individuals that are going to come in contact with unvaccinated people. And that is a difficult challenge to make that balance. And I think we're trying to be as thoughtful as we can, and as Representative Riccielli said, let's open this up. Let's open up the public dialogue and get all opinions and make an informed judgment.
All right. Thank you very much. We have about 20 minutes left in tonight's call, so if you haven't had a chance to ask your question yet, there's still time. All you have to do is press *3 to be connected with a volunteer who will put you in the question queue. Again, that's *3. So now we're going to take a question from Holly about the minimum wage and the middle class economy. Holly, go ahead.
Hello. Yes, we heard a couple of comments tonight about the COLA and transportation expenses and where does the money go and that sort of thing. And I would like to suggest that when amounts are created for increases in wages, salaries, and whatever, whether it's the DOT or teachers or any other public domain, that they be made in dollars rather than percentages. As you know, when you compound numbers, those who have the most then would get the most. Those who have the least get the least when it's done in percentages. And so people on Social Security and low-income people haven't really had an increase in years. And so if you would consider using dollars and minimize the use of averages and percentages, because if your head's in the oven and your feet are in the freezer, on average you're just right, and that's what averages amount to. So I would like to make that proposal something to think about. Thank you.
Thank you, Holly. This is Tim Ormsby, and that I think is a that's a very innovative suggestion. And I would just say, from when we do these all of these state employee negotiations for wages are collectively bargained. So the governor's office and the bargaining representatives for the governor are there on behalf of state government, and the employee bargaining representatives are there on behalf of their members that work in whatever bargaining unit within state government. And that is a part of the sacrosanct rule that we have about collective bargaining. It's part of the National Labor Relations Act. It's something that we could not unilaterally change, but I think you have an interesting idea about doing dollar amounts that would be a higher percentage for the lower wage workers. But those are things that we need to defer to the collective bargaining laws, both national and state, and that's what we're doing. And in the preview to your asking a question about the state government contracts, it was a comment from Jack, our moderator, about the minimum wage. And although you didn't ask that part of it, I'd like to weigh in on behalf of the minimum wage and increasing it from its current $9 and near 50 cents an hour to $12 an hour by 2019. And that is a bill that I've been involved in the last few years, and a bill that I voted in support of to go out of the House Labor Committee, and will hopefully be considered on the floor of the House of Representatives, because we need to do something for our average wage earner out there in order to be able to make ends meet, given the fact that this income disparity is so wide that we need to do something for the folks on the low end of the wage ladder. And I think that's one of the things we can do to increase their purchasing power and their positive impact on the economy.
All right. Thank you very much for your answers to that question. Reminder, folks, all you have to do is press *3 tonight to be connected to a volunteer who will put you in the question queue. We still have a bit of time left to take as many questions as possible, so make sure to get yours in there if you can. All right, now we're going to take a question from Mandy. Mandy, go ahead. You're live.
Yes, I appreciate your leadership, and we have a lot to celebrate in Spokane as our school levy just passed. I'd like to hear a little bit about what guidance is provided to help the schools make the most of this opportunity, both in meeting the upcoming needs of as education is changing so much, but also in keeping the jobs local in the construction.
Yeah, so I'll take the first part, and actually maybe Representative Ormsby will take the local construction question, because that's certainly his area of expertise. But this is Andy Billig. Congratulations to Spokane Public Schools. I'm glad you brought that up. And, you know, more importantly, to the students, teachers, and citizens in the Spokane School District for passing that levy and bond. Really a testament to the support for education in our community and to our future. You know, one of the things in terms of guidance, so there's a ton of guidance, all of these laws. Guidance is what some people might call it. Other people who don't like all that guidance might call them mandates or regulations. But we have a lot. But ultimately, our system of education in Washington is one of local control. We have 295 school districts throughout our state, each governed by an elected board. And it's really kind of a neat system when you think about it that we've said, you know, we're going to let each community take the education of their kids under their wings and help to bring them up in the way they see fit with, you know, some standards and guidance. So I'd say it's a mix. Would probably be the short answer to the local control. But I think your construction question is a good one as well, and I'll turn that over to Representative Morsky.
Well, thanks, Senator Billig, and thank you, Mandy. And I would just give a shout-out as well to all of the successful regional school districts that had bond and levies up last night. That's a huge economic development opportunity, which is the second part of your question. How can we ensure that we're going to, that the taxpayers that are going to support the construction of and modernization of those schools and also support our teachers and students are going to be able to realize the benefits of it? And this goes back to this age-old idea that taxpayer money contributed for the public benefit should benefit taxpayers. So we want our people in those school districts that are paying the property taxes to support those bonds to get those jobs. And this is an issue I've been active on for over 10 years, and there are some limitations on what we can do because the federal constitution says you can't, you know, the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution says you can't give preference to contractors that go across state lines. The Privileges and Immunities Clause of the U.S. Constitution says you can't give preference to one individual in one part of the country that you don't extend those same privileges and immunities to somebody else, someone else in the country. But given those constraints, I will give some credit to Spokane Public Schools, which 98% of the students that we represent are Spokane Public Schools students, that the Spokane Public Schools has done a good job of making sure that we are getting that value and that we are hiring contractors and workers. We can do better. We can do better, and with this upcoming bond, that will be something we're all engaged in, me in particular, to make sure that those taxpayer dollars benefit local taxpayers in the job component of this school construction.
And I'll just add, this is Marcus, that I do think we need to look at it in consideration for you know, we have to take the low bid on these projects, and that there should be some sort of consideration that if we can thread that needle of constitutionality, that we should do it to make sure that those dollars are staying local. And I do appreciate Representative Ormsby's leadership on this and Spokane Public Schools for really talking a lot about this issue when we come in front of them.
All right. Thank you all very much. All right, folks, we got time for a couple more questions on tonight's call, but I did want to take a chance to let you know that if we don't get to your question tonight, make sure to stay on the line, because as soon as the call's done, you'll have the chance to leave a voicemail directly for Senator Billig and Representatives Ormsby and Richelli, and your voicemail will go to them tomorrow with your questions, comments, or feedback regarding tonight's call. So if we don't get to you, please stay on the line, because you'll still have a chance to pass a message on. All right, we're going to go to a question from Annette about prescription medication. Annette, go ahead.
My question is, where are we going to get the money to pay for medical complications from inability of people to pay for medications that control many chronic and incurable diseases? You may live as long as anyone else, but your disease may be incurable for a lifetime. And I bring that up because both the news and myself from experience has experienced dramatic medicine increases. And I will give you one for instance. I have one medication that I paid, and my insurance combined, the both of us paid $28 for in November. That same prescription for the same 3 months in, I may have my months wrong, but the price was $501. That's a monumental increase, and I can assure.
Oh, are you there, Annette? Oh, okay, well, I think we lost you, but let me, this is Representative Richelli, and I just wanted to answer your question here. So, first of all, seniors shouldn't be choosing between the ability to purchase food and purchase their prescription drugs. So we're absolutely committed to making prescription drugs more affordable. I do want to give a special shout-out to Dr. Sam Selinger, who started a prescription drug assistance program in Spokane that's moved statewide to offer seniors another venue to get prescription drug. And I have a bill that is working on that, because with Medicaid expansion, we brought a lot of folks online to get prescription drug assistance. But the bill changes to not just say the uninsured, but the underinsured, because we know there's a lot of folks who are struggling. That's a small program, and I think it's the type of program we'd like to work out of existence. We certainly are focused on it in the healthcare committee, and we need to look at how we can bring down those costs. So as vice chair of the healthcare committee, I'm going to continue to work on that and make sure that we can make our prescription drugs more affordable for everybody across the line.
Thank you for your answer to that question. Sorry we lost you, Annette. Hope you were able to stay on and listen to that. All right, now we're going to take a question from Len about initiatives. Len, go ahead.
Gentlemen, voting time, we see initiatives constantly and, well, often, but no funding source. So while the idea sounds good, but then when the bill comes, people complain, and it kind of – seems to me like there should be a funding source or an idea of how much tax is going to go up so people can vote on this stuff and the state can do what they need to do. If it's raise taxes or cut another program, there should be a funding source attached to initiatives.
Thanks, Len. This is Tim Ormsby, and I think you're absolutely right. We do need to be able to provide to the voters kind of the truth in initiatives interest, but and it's not just on the creation of programs that, or you know, we spoke earlier about the teacher COLA, which was an initiative. There was an initiative for class size at the same time. We most recently had an initiative to lower class size again, Initiative 1351. That has some huge fiscal impacts to the state budget were we to do it. But and I think that folks should be aware of what it's going to cost. The funding source issue is something for the legislature to have to figure out once that initiative passes. But people were told basically what the cost was going to be. There wasn't a funding source attached to it or an option to shut down other programs. On the flip side, when we limit the amount of money that comes to government through, you know, whether it's property tax, limiting property tax increases, or whether there's a two-thirds requirement to have taxes, or whether we, you know, completely you know, that we lower the card tab fees. All of those things have consequences on both the money that comes into the state and things that would be required. And I'm for a truth and initiative and transparency that people know on both sides of the coin what money is not going to come into the state to fund programs people think that are important or programs that are going to cost money and how much that is going to be.
Yeah, I agree, and I think Representative Hornsby summarized that well. You know, we do have a bill. We just heard had a hearing on it in Ways and Means a couple of days ago. It's sponsored by Senator Fain, if you want to look that up on the legislative website, that would have added on, because we already have what's called a fiscal note. So if there's an initiative, voters and other interested parties can go online and see how much it's going to cost. The problem is that it's complicated. A lot of voters don't do that just because it takes time and energy, and maybe they don't know where it's located. And then once you see the fiscal note, it's quite technical the way it's written. So this bill that we're considering would require on the ballot, if an initiative was going to have a fiscal impact of over, I believe it's $20 million, there would be a statement on the ballot that would say this initiative has a fiscal impact of greater than $20 million and could result in either increased revenue through taxes or decreased spending and cuts in programs if it were to pass. I don't know if that bill will pass, but it certainly would be a step towards what you're talking about. And that's Senate Bill 5715.
All right. Thank you very much. So we're running out of time, but again, I just want to remind everyone on the call that if we are unable to get to your question tonight, please stay on the line because you'll be transferred to a line to leave a voicemail for your elected representatives that will be delivered to them tomorrow. So we're going to take a question now from Carol about education. Carol, go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen, and thank you for your representation of the 3rd District. My concern is maintaining a skilled workforce. I understand the implications of McCleary, but I think we all understand, too, that a high school diploma isn't adequate anymore to provide an economy and provide access to jobs with good salaries. So I'm not only concerned about creating new jobs, but we also need to be concerned with the crisis of replacement jobs, whether it's the machinists at workers at Boeing, Vista linemen, the shipyard workers in Bellingham or in Bremerton. All of those people are going to retire, and we need skilled workers to replace them. So my concern, being a board member for the community colleges, is that we keep community and technical colleges affordable and continue, rather than continue to place the shortage of state support on students, that we don't continue to increase tuition.
Well, thanks, Carol, and it's great to hear from you, and thank you for your service for the community colleges. I was very pleased to be at the opening of the wing there at the community colleges in your honor for all your service. Thanks for calling in tonight. This is Representative Marcus Riccielli, and you're absolutely right. If we're going to grow our economy from the middle out, we have to make sure that there's affordable education that is post-high school. And that includes making sure that folks have a path to either vocational and technical school to a 2-year or a 4-year degree. I really like what the president has brought on the table to consider, that we're putting it at a minimum of 2 years of education on the table for folks, because that's how we're going to ensure that we can have the next generation compete in a global economy. And we are absolutely pricing our students out of that education. The debt load that folks are taking on is just really, really difficult for a lot of students coming out of college, and we got to make sure that we keep it in reach. It should be a happy time when folks graduate. It shouldn't be a time when they're concerned about the job they're going to take, whether they can purchase a home or whether they can start a family.
And if I can weigh in, and also, Carol, thank you very much for your service both locally and at the state for our community and technical colleges. And you're absolutely right about high school degree is not just enough anymore. And you know, but for the benefit of the other listeners, it takes at least 1 year of post-high school education of some kind, whether it's through apprenticeship or certifications they might get at the community college or another year of instruction is necessary, which really vastly increases people's earning potential over a lifetime. And I would say that your comment on tuition is spot on. We need to make these experiences affordable for our students. So if we freeze tuition, we need to make the institutions whole, because if they're not getting the tuition increases, even if it's just an inflationary increase, it's actually a cut somewhere else. So we need to make our institutions whole, and you know that's going to be in the $100+ million to make all the 2- and 4-year schools whole if we freeze tuition. So we can't just provide relief to the students. We have to make sure that the institutions provide world-class education opportunities and that we don't short the institution's ability to provide that quality experience for students. So we need to pony up here in the legislature to keep the institutions whole while keeping it tuition affordable for students.
All right. Thank you, Carol, for that great question. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for questions tonight. But again, if we didn't get to your question, please stay on the line, because in just a moment you'll have the chance to leave a voicemail directly for Senator Billig and Representatives Ormsby and Richelli with your questions, comments, or feedback. Your voicemail will be delivered to them tomorrow morning. Thanks again for joining tonight's conversation. And now I'll turn it over to the group for some final thoughts.
Thank you so much. This is Representative Marcus Richelli, and thanks for joining us tonight. It's such an honor to represent you and be calling you from your capital. You know, we represent roughly 137,000 folks, and I really feel that you are the employer. We are your employees, and your feedback is absolutely critical as we move forward. So I'm going to remain focused on creating jobs, enhancing education, protecting our most vulnerable, and making sure that we have healthy kids and healthy families for our community. Thank you so much for the opportunity to serve, and I'll turn it over to Representative Ormsby.
Thank you, Representative Richelli, and I just echo Marcus' thoughts on this. We are here on your behalf, and we need to know what you think in order to make an informed judgment that benefits the community that we're here to serve. And I just want to say again how pleased I am to be working with these two gentlemen in this teamwork model that we've developed, and each supporting each other. And the reason we do that is to make sure that we're supporting the people back home and that we're meeting your needs. And again, please stay on the line for a little bit longer if you had a question that wasn't answered, so that we can get your voicemail in the morning and get back to you with answers to your questions. Thanks for joining us.
And this is Senator Andy Billig, and just want to echo those comments and say thank you to everybody on the line. We'll keep working hard on providing opportunity and building prosperity. That's really what it boils down to for me as I consider different legislation and work on your behalf here. And, you know, a healthy democracy demands participation and by the citizenry. And so I just appreciate so much those that were listening, those that asked questions, and for everyone who will hopefully stay in touch with us. Last comment, wanted to remind everybody that March 14th, we will have a live town hall meeting in Spokane. We don't have the time or the location set yet, but Saturday, March 14th, it'll probably be sometime in the morning. And you can follow all of that and all of these bills we've talked about on the legislative website, which we've mentioned a few times, and that's www.leg.wa.gov.
Before we sign off, excuse me.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I know that we have a strong veteran community back in the Spokane area, and I met with the director of the Washington State Veterans Affairs and told her we were doing this town hall, and she asked me to make sure that you all knew the Veterans Benefit Hotline number, which is an 800 number for anybody that has any questions about potential benefits to Washington State residents from the Washington State Veterans Administration. The number is 1-800-562-2308. Again, that's 1-800-562-2308, and they'd be happy to hear from you.
Thanks. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.